Our guest has travelled the world performing, formed his own dance company, won an Olivier Award and been honoured by the Queen. As a kid, Akram Khan used to dance on the tables of his father's curry restaurant in South London. A new documentary about Akram called The Curry House Kid will be shown at the Auckland Arts Festival next March, followed by a panel discussion. When he was 20, struggling with his Bangladeshi culture and his father's expectations that he'd take over the curry house, Akram broke ranks and became a professional dancer. But in the film, Akram revisits London's iconic curry capital, Brick Lane, returning to his memories of growing up with his Bangladeshi parents and to the violence and racism that shaped his everyday life. All of it culminating in an hypnotic dance piece where he celebrates his people's journey, telling the story of the immigrant experience in Britain. Akram is with us, I think, from Paris at the moment. Hi, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Lovely to have you here. Let's set the scene, really. Many New Zealanders would have been to Brick Lane on their OE or their time living in the UK. But for those who haven't, please describe its historic appeal and its character.
Well, it's an incredible place because it was really a place for immigrants. You know, it was very downtrodden. It was a slum, really. It's so funny going back now. It's so bizarre, actually, because it's so gentrified now. But, you know, some time ago, there were all, Huguenots, and then the Jewish community moved in, and then the Bangladeshi community moved in, and now it's becoming gentrified. So, in a sense, returning back to the story of the curry house, you know, I always knew of it as a place where curry house restaurants were striving, and it was the kind of birth, in a way, a birthplace for curry house. And now it's amazing because there's loads of tourists that go there. While we were filming, there were thousands and thousands of tourists every day in different languages. Tourist guides would be leading tourists through. So it's become a very iconic place, but it's also very tragic because, you know, things move on and it's becoming gentrified. So, yeah.
That's the story of so much of London in many ways and of many of the world's great cities, is that much of the rich tapestry of their inhabitants over many years find themselves being pushed further and further to the periphery because they've become gentrified, they've become a place for those of great wealth.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's really striking for me while I was doing Curry House Kid, and more so now today, you know, it's the story of my childhood experience of working in my dad's restaurant and the racism that we faced. And you know, Brick Lane was no different to that. I mean, it was the center of racist attacks once upon a time, and xenophobic feelings were very strong then. And here I am talking to you today in 2019, toward the end of 2019. And here we are with Brexit and xenophobic uprising all around the world. And, you know, I thought London is my home. I was born and brought up there. And it's just so surreal talking about something we thought had at least quietened down to a certain extent. It never disappeared, but I think that was the mistake. I thought it had disappeared, but it's always been there, but just quieter. Now it's just become very popular to be racist.
Let's go back to those experiences and the story that you tell through the documentary, the ubiquitous Indian curry house, here more likely to be called an Indian restaurant. However, it was Bangladeshi people who were running so many, like your father and like your family, who were running so many of these restaurants.
Yes, I mean, you know, it's mostly Bangladeshi people who run the Indian restaurants. I think it was quite popular to call it Indian because when you say Bangladesh, well, Bangladesh was formed in 1971. So at that time, it was a recent, you know, country. It was a new country. It had its independence in 71. So people really didn't know Bangladesh that much. They knew India, so they decided to call it Indian restaurant. But My community is slightly different in the sense that, you know, I grew up in South London, but my people, if you like, my parents' people, Bangladeshis, there were a lot of them, you know, who came out of East London. But, you know, I grew up in South London, but that was more the kind of capital. People who came from the capital city, Dhaka, were in South London. So I grew up in that community, and they were highly academic, actually. So, you know, I couldn't fit into the academics because it just wasn't my thing. And so my father thought, you know, what future does he have? Let me just push him into taking over his business, really, at one point, because I was failing all my academic studies. But also, I had no future in dance at the time. You know, I was training like crazy, but for what? There was no infrastructure for Indian classical dance, or no opportunities, if you like. And here I am today. I'm very fortunate to have a break in the dance circuit, and I'm doing okay.
Your story is many things. It is a family story. It is, as we said, an immigrant family's story, and it is the story of the racism of the times, both then and now. Let's go back to the situation you were in, working in the restaurant. As you said, your father had seen this as the future for you, that you would inherit it and take it over, but you were always dancing. And what is the story of the dancing for you as a boy?
Well, you know, for me, dancing, why I loved dancing was because there was this huge, as a child, I saw Michael Jackson, I saw Charlie Chaplin, I saw Bruce Lee, Muhammad Ali, I saw Buster Keaton, Fred Astaire. These were my kind of superheroes. I mean, my biggest superhero was my mother, because she loved culture and arts. But for me, dancing as a child was a freeing experience from my identity, but also it was a freeing from gender specification, because when I danced, I felt both male and female. More accurately, I would say none of the above. I felt genderless, in a sense. And, you know, dance has been my companion ever since, along the journey that I call life. It became my identity. It was my identity, if anything more than being Bangladeshi or British or brown. It just kind of, for me, rose above those lines of identity.
Was it liberating also personally? Was it a means of self-expression always for you?
It's the only moment. You know, I was a very shy kid. I was very explosive physically. You know, at the time, my school teachers, my community didn't quite understand why I was so hyperactive. Now they clinically say, you know, ADHD or something like that. But at the time, it was not diagnosed. But I was hyper. I couldn't sit still. So for me, it was a sense of channeling that energy into something more refined and focused. And that gave me a great pleasure, but also it became my voice, because I was so intimidated by my peers or my friends in the community who were all going to private school, who had very, very good academic scores, and I couldn't get into private school. So I was very intimidated by language itself, speaking language. And so, you know, my mum said to me, reminded me that I couldn't put a sentence together until the age of 7. A full sentence together. So that's how behind I was. But yet I could do a choreography of 5 minutes, 10 minutes, at the age of 3. So obviously movement and the language of movement was more natural to me and more direct than the language of words.
And how important to have an outlet for that expression, which every child needs, and how wonderful that it was. Dance, that was it. It's interesting you spoke about being a little fiery as a kid, and one wonders if some of that was frustration and released and relieved by the ability to dance, to express yourself.
Yes, I mean, you know, I couldn't fit in. I was always a shadow, really. I couldn't fit into being a posh Bangladeshi educated boy. I couldn't fit into the restaurant business as a chef or a waiter. It just did not work with me. I couldn't quite feel at home at school because we had to sit behind a desk to be told what to eat, to acquire knowledge. We had to be told what that knowledge was. So it was not experienced knowledge. I wasn't experiencing that information. So it wasn't embodied knowledge. And I always believed somehow, I couldn't put it into words, but you know, Nietzsche once said, there is more wisdom in your body than in your deepest philosophy. And for me, I always believed in that somehow. And you know, I struggled fitting in anywhere. And my mother always said, look, you know, she was great. She said, be yourself because everyone else is taken. Don't be like everyone else. And I did some research and I realized she must have read Oscar Wilde, because that quote comes from Oscar Wilde, be yourself, everyone else is taken. So, but it always stuck with me, and it stayed with me that I had to be myself. I couldn't be somebody else that the community wanted or that my father wanted.
Let's discuss the racism of that time first. And it would come into the restaurant, customers would come to love the food, but then be racist to those serving it, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they loved the food, I'm not sure. Maybe they did, but we were open till late. And, you know, in those days in the 90s, the restaurants would, the pubs would close early. So they would drink as much as they could and then turn up at the restaurant to have a curry. So it was quite a culture of that. And then my father would allow them in and we would have to be there till three, literally getting abused, verbally abused, sometimes physically abused. Police would come and interrogate us, not even interrogate the people who had abused us, as if we were the problem makers. And, you know, that shaped a lot of my thinking at that time of, you know, racism, you know, and what it does to someone who has to deal with that on a daily basis. It was tough. It was a tough period of my childhood, I would say. My father got the real brunt, the harsh end of it, because he tried to protect me a lot. But I was very aware of my color, you know, at that age. Until then, until working in my dad's restaurant, I saw Michael Jackson, I saw Bruce Lee, I saw Muhammad Ali on TV all the time. So I wasn't that aware of color. I was just aware of how loud the body can speak. And then when I started working at my dad's restaurant, I realized that actually people see me as a brown person. People see me as an immigrant, even though I was born there. So until that moment, and then I'd forgotten about it once I started doing well in dance. And then when the terrorist bombs went off in America, I suddenly was, and of course in England in 2005, in the summer, I suddenly saw myself through the lens of a white person, and I thought, oh, here's a brown man on a train. And now here I am today, aware of my color again. So politics, how we see each other or the other, has always been very near me, in my experience.
You speak in the documentary with Yusuf, who worked in a restaurant from 11 years old and is still doing so now. And you mention your experience of racism. His was extreme and also led in part, I think, or became part of an uprising that led to the battle for Brick Lane. Could you talk a little of this part of the story and how acute...
Yeah, I mean...
how acutely things came to a head.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a very important moment and a very tragic moment at the same time, because Yusuf was stabbed and his friend was stabbed as well and, you know... by racists, and his friend died, And, you know, there was an uprising. And the Bangladeshi said, enough is enough. You know, we need to protect our people. We don't feel safe. The women and children and men don't feel, young men don't feel safe. And so there was an uprising. And they kind of won that battle to a certain extent, in the sense that it became their territory, because they wanted it to be safe for them and everyone else. And that was a pivotal moment for Bangladeshis, I think, generally, and for London, really. That culture, fighting for self-respect and also, you know, a need to live in safety rather than in fear of your life every day. So that changed the kind of landscape. It had a repercussion all over, I think, all over England.
It is a story where you revisit what you had left and feel again acutely, as you said, an identity again, or perhaps even confronted with an identity again. Let's talk of how the dance career developed. You preferred the restaurant when it was empty. You danced at the restaurant then, craved an audience. You learnt to play the tabla, a traditional Bangladeshi drum, for your aunties to sing along to. But when and how did the dance begin to become serious and professional? What was that moment?
Well, I was very lucky, because at 13, I had joined Peter Brook's seminal work, The Mahabharata, a play that he created with some of the most incredible actors that he invited into this production. And I was just a, you know, young 13-year-old who hadn't been in theatre before that, in theatre plays, if you like, had only been in dance productions. And so that changed my thinking, my whole outlook. I mean, you know, I don't want to claim this, but in a sense, his influence has changed the way I see the world. And I didn't realize at the time that it would do that. And the way I see art as well. So when I came back from a two-year tour, I was 15 and a young man then. And I straight went to school, which I struggled with. I went into the restaurant to work on weekends to make some money and also to help out my dad. And that really traumatized me. And dance was my savior, if you like, because I needed an outlet. I needed to allow the injustice and the rage that I felt because of the injustice through my body, in a sense. And dance was that outlet. And so I started taking dance very seriously. There was a whole year where I skipped school, actually, and my parents didn't know until I got caught, of course. And they said, where were you? You haven't attended school for a year. Where have you been? And I took them to my dad's garage, the back of the garden, and that's where I was hiding out for 10 hours, 8 to 10 hours a day. And I thought, well, I'm not going to just do nothing. I'd go crazy sitting here pretending, you know, hiding out. So I started to train myself. And yeah, that's what I did. I trained in Indian classical dance, and I practiced and I practiced and I practiced and I practiced. That's all I did. I was obsessed with it. But that gave me the greatest joy, I have to say.
This is it Kathak? Is that how it is pronounced?
That's right, yeah.
And what you've done over time, really, is would we describe it as a form of fusion with Western contemporary dance? Has that come to be, I guess, what you are renowned for?
Yeah, I mean, I would be careful to call it fusion. I mean, I think that fusion is too simplistic, and people like to label it. They need a label, so they call it fusion. I prefer to call it confusion. Because my body was confused between, you know, when you study a form and then you know, I've imitated Michael Jackson, I've imitated Bruce Lee, I've imitated a lot of my superheroes, really, at that time. And that was also in my body, and breakdowns was in my body, because I used to love breakdancing. And then, of course, I studied contemporary dance, and my contemporary dance teachers were going, well, that's not really what you're doing is not purely contemporary dance, or whatever purely meant. But they were more positive towards it. My Guruji, my Indian classical teacher, was more worried about it because he felt, he was a bit frustrated because he felt there was an alien language being confused with the Kathak. And so I like to call it, I prefer to call it a state of confusion, really, and I started to investigate that state of confusion. And so my work is mainly about myths, really. I'm very interested in myths and re-looking at myths from because I felt myths have always been predominantly from a male perspective, and history has been predominantly written by white males. So I wanted to change the lens. I wanted the entry point differently. I wanted to enter the myth differently from a woman's perspective or from another perspective, basically. And so a lot of my work is about storytelling and sharing myths from another perspective.
Myths and history also. Was it Xenos, I think, that was created to mark the centenary of World War One? And it explores the stories of the Indian soldiers, more than a million of them, who fought for Great Britain in the battlefields of Europe. Your choreography, your dance development process then, in this very fluid and instinctive style you have made your own, will you literally, when you are exploring a new work, will you just move? Will you just start dancing? How does the choreography happen?
The choreography more and more happens at the end, you know. We spend a year researching. So, you know, I don't make this alone. I have a tribe of collaborators, lighting designers, that I work very closely with and for a long period of time, spent years with them. My dramaturg is very, very close to me, Ruth Little. Maven Koo, my rehearsal director and coach, if you like. The composer, Vincenzo Lamagna, who composed the music. I've worked with him on several projects, Giselle being one of them, for English National Ballet, and Xenos, of course, what he made. And the costume designer, Kimi Nakano. So I work with a team of people, and we talk a lot, and we collect a lot of information. And Xenos was really about looking back at archives, really, because Indian soldiers, well, colonial soldiers, were slowly, well, directly edited out of history because it was from a white lens, white man's lens, if you like. History is written by white man because they're the victors in the Western world. So in a sense, I was very upset, and I think my whole team were very upset because in the centenary, we were like, hang on, why did I never study this in history? Why did 4 million colonial soldiers die and not be acknowledged? Or not die, but a lot of them fought in the First World War. But they were not acknowledged. And I felt, no, we need to retell this story again. We need to retell. It's so funny that it's called history, his story. And I question that. Why isn't it called her story? You know, I mean, there's so much about the way we see our past, which is so one-dimensional and politically from a specific perspective. So how do we move towards the future if we don't really know the truth of our past?
Akram,
I think
thank
that's
you.
Where we are right now as a civilization.
Thank you so much, Akram Khan. And he is going to be performing at the Auckland Arts Festival next March, The Curry House Kid, which includes an extraordinary dance telling this part of his story.